Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Our sport is a risky sport.
We are at the mercy of the mountain itself.
Rock covered in snow and ice.
The risk of avalanches from bad weather.
Hypothermia.
Altitude sickness.
Exhaustion.
It's not a natural environment for survival.
Chasing mountains. Listen now by searching for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 11th of May, these are our main stories. The United Nations has voted to enhance Palestine's membership rights. Russia has launched a cross-border attack near the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. And two British climate protesters in their 80s have been arrested after smashing the glass case containing a historic legal document. Also in this podcast...
It's taken almost 3 months. Longer than I thought, because my audience is not normal. My audience is tax nerds and lawyers, the kind of weirdos who do actually read the small print.
A free bottle of wine hidden in a website's small print has finally been claimed after 3 months by someone who bothered to read the terms and conditions. It's perhaps yet another sign of Israel's growing isolation on the international stage. With the war in Gaza continuing, the United Nations General Assembly has voted overwhelmingly to grant Palestine enhanced rights within the organisation, and it's called for it to be accepted as a full member. And this comes amid reports that several more European countries plan officially to recognise Palestine as a state. There was, not surprisingly, a furious response to the vote from Israel. Indeed, a rather graphic one. Its envoy to the UN, Gilad Erdan, used a mini shredder to destroy a small copy of the United Nations Charter.
Today, I will hold up a mirror for you so that you can see exactly what you are inflicting upon the UN Charter with this destructive vote. You are shredding the UN Charter with your own hands. Yes, yes, that's what you're doing. Shredding the UN Charter. Shame on you.
United Nations debates have often been rather fiery, but there's still merits as one of the organisation's more dramatic moments, according to our correspondent in New York, John Sudworth. Indeed, he told Janat Jalil, it's one which may well go down in the history books.
First off, we can say that to the acts of protest on the floor of the General Assembly over the years, including, of course, Nikita Khrushchev's infamous shoe-banging incident, we can now add the use of the mini shredder. This was a day of some pretty striking language in the debate and some pretty striking scenes. It all comes, of course, after the rejection of the bid for full Palestinian membership last month. That was rejected by the Security Council over the US use of its veto. And this is, if you like, in essence, the General Assembly taking matters into its own hands. We ought to say that the General Assembly does not have the power to confer full membership to Palestine. That is a power that only belongs to the Security Council. So this was largely symbolic. The resolution reiterated the call for that to be done. But it does also make a few material changes. It does confer on Palestine, in its non-member observer status, a few extra rights and privileges. So, for example, this vote going through today will mean that Palestine will now enjoy the ability to take part in pretty much all debates, which it didn't have before, that it'll be able to propose agenda items, and it will be able to get its representatives nominated to committees. And all of that was enough for the Israeli ambassador to see this as a breach of the UN Charter, as an attempt to confer many of the attributes of statehood on Palestine through the back door. And that's why we saw him shredding this pocket-sized version of the UN Charter, pushing it through that little mini shredder that he brought up with him to the podium.
And despite Israel's protests, Palestinians are getting more support from across the world since the war broke out on October the 7th. With reports that some European countries are planning to recognise a Palestinian state.
Yeah, that's right. 143 members of the General Assembly voting in favour of this resolution. Many of them, of course, already have formally recognised Palestinian statehood. But a lot of people arguing for this today because they see it as a potential sort of watershed to encourage more to do so. You know, some pretty impassioned speeches on both sides, a retrenchment in many ways of familiar positions from many of the nations involved. The United States backing Israel, saying that in its view, that statehood and the status that would be accorded by full membership of the United Nations should not come before a peace process, that all this needs to be worked out following a peace process. But those arguing in favour of this motion today, suggesting that after 85 years, the time has come, even if this gesture is symbolic, to stand behind it.
John Sudworth. With all this drama going on at the UN, the United States government has said that Israel may have used American-supplied weapons in breach of international humanitarian law during the war in Gaza. The findings came in a review ordered by the White House. Our correspondent Tom Bateman is in Washington.
This has been a very long-awaited report by the State Department. It was ordered by President Biden back in February under increasing pressure over the allegations that Israel had breached international humanitarian law in Gaza. The administration's actually missed its own deadline by 3 days on this. Such was the pressure it says it put itself under to try and get this absolutely right. Now, what the document says is that it makes a reasonable assessment that Israel may have breached international humanitarian law in some instances in Gaza. But it caveats that. It says it doesn't have complete information. And also, it believes that Israel does have mechanisms to try to bring accountability to sort of remediate all of these instances. But the bottom line is that this report is critical of Israel's actions in Gaza, albeit in a rather sort of broad and non-specific way. And fundamentally, it stops short of going to the full extent of the power that the president has on this particular issue, which is to withhold weapons shipments if the assessment is that there is a clear case that international humanitarian law has been breached. So it doesn't say that there should be any further holding of US weapons to Israel, coming in a week, of course, where the president confirmed that one arms shipment has already been halted to the Israelis.
Tom Bateman. So, a controversial report unveiled in Washington, a particularly bitter row at the United Nations headquarters in New York. But meanwhile, the UN's agency in Jerusalem has also been going through some high drama. UNRWA looks after Palestinians who fled to Gaza and the occupied West Bank, but it's had to close its Jerusalem office after being the target of an arson attack. The head of UNRWA blamed what he called Israeli extremists, who've been holding regular protests outside its compound. This follows an accusation by the Israeli government that several UNRWA workers were involved in the Hamas attacks of October 7th, though an independent review found that Israel still hadn't supplied any evidence for this. James Menendez spoke to UNRWA's Jonathan Fowler. He was actually in the compound when the fire started.
There were a number of us still in the office. This was, you know, around sort of 6 p.m. or thereabouts. And suddenly we heard the fire alarms and then started to see smoke coming over the rooftop of the building we're in. And it was immediately clear that the smoke was coming from the edge of the compound. Colleagues rushed out to see what was happening. And there's sort of uncut grass and so on the outside of the fence of the compound. And clearly persons unknown had set fire to it. And at this point, you know, the flames were taking hold and the fire service was called. But in the meantime, a couple of colleagues got the hose pipe and some fire extinguishers to try and contain either end of the fire. And while they were trying to put the fire out, there were youths who were watching from across the road who started throwing stones at them. We have seen these groups of young people around the compound before. I mean, they regularly gather around the time colleagues are leaving at the end of the working day to throw stones at the vehicles, throw stones at individuals who are trying to leave. We kind of recognized who they were. And these were clearly Israeli kids, very, very young, sort of, you know, 13, 14, 15. But there were a number of older people with them.
But there's no doubt in your mind that the fire was started deliberately.
Oh, no, that's absolutely clear, because another one then popped up on the other side of the compound. So one, yes, who knows, but the second one, you know, clearly, I mean, when there's two fires, you know, the second one was actually much more dangerous because it was on the edge of the compound where we have our petrol station.
These protests, though, that you talk about, and they have happened before, this is all related to your work in Gaza and the government's assertion that UNRWA has been infiltrated by Hamas, do you think?
To an extent. I mean, put it this way, there's a lot of fiery rhetoric, and then, you know, you can draw a direct line between that and somebody literally lighting a fire. I mean, there've been a number of accusations against UNRWA in the past, you know, and of course they've reached a sharper pitch over the course of the war in Gaza, but unsubstantiated for the most part. I mean, Philippe Lazzarini, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, has repeatedly flagged the fact that there's an overall campaign to dismantle our work. And that's ranged from stuff about what's going on in Gaza through to, you know, the tragic attacks on our facilities in Gaza, the killing of our staff. Now, these are sort of all manifestations of a wider effort. You know, we've had issues with VAT, we've had bank accounts frozen, but the demonstrations, they've been turning up the dial. Generally, these demonstrations, more or less peaceful, but we've had staff have these toy guns pointed at them. We've had people putting bloodied handprints on our walls.
Do the police ever come to these protests? Do they ever intervene?
Earlier on, when the protests were first happening, the police actually came and they set up barriers and did all these kind of things. You know, so it was much more policed, if you like. But over the recent occurrences, these demonstrators kind of come back more or less weekly. The police action, if you like, has almost declined as the level of violence and intimidation has actually grown.
UNRWA spokesman Jonathan Fowler. The BBC asked for comments from the Israeli Foreign Ministry and police regarding the incident, but nobody's got back to us. Meanwhile, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said that the bloc strongly condemns the attack. He said it was Israel's responsibility to ensure the safety of humanitarian workers. Now, Russian forces have launched a cross-border attack near Ukraine's second city of Kharkiv in the northeast of the country, opening a potential new front in the war that's long been waged in the east and south. President Zelensky says a fierce battle is now being waged there.
Russia started a new wave of offensive actions in the Kharkiv region. Ukrainian forces met them there with brigades and artillery fire. It's important to understand that they can increase and bring more forces in this direction. It is a fact.
Reports suggest that Russian troops have made some advances, but Ukraine says they have been pushed back. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale is in Kharkiv. The Russian attack, he says, certainly didn't come as a surprise.
I think if you talk to Ukrainians, and certainly Western intelligence officials I've spoken to, they knew that Russia was building up forces just over the border. But Russia's focus has been in the east this year. This year alone, it has already taken about 300 square miles of Ukrainian territory, making slow but steady progress. But this attack, so they've been massing troops just over the border, and this is essentially a new front for this year. And those troops, in small numbers, as you say, cross the border, followed by massive, in Ukraine's words, artillery and airstrikes. And that those troops, those small numbers of Russian troops, have now got a foothold just across the border. Now, it doesn't threaten this city. This is Ukraine's second largest city of Kharkiv in terms of Russia at the gates, which it was at the start of this war. But remember, this city is pretty much being targeted every single night by Russian airstrikes and missile strikes. Indeed, there's been an air alarm warning since 9 a.m. still going on now here. But it does show that Russia is stretching Ukraine right across this 800-mile front in the south, now in the north, and also in the east, where it's made its most significant gains. Is it clear that President Putin believes he has this window of opportunity in the coming months to make some significant gains? That's what he hopes. And that situation of Ukraine being outgunned and outmanned has been exacerbated by that slow US military support. It took 6 months for it to be approved, and it is only now slowly arriving. So Ukraine is really being tested, and it is now facing an attack on numerous fronts.
Jonathan Beale in Kharkiv. And now to India. The sounds of jubilant supporters greeting the Chief Minister of Delhi, Arvind Kejriwal, as he walked out of prison. A leading opponent of the Indian Prime Minister, Mr. Kejriwal has been granted temporary bail in a corruption case. India is in the middle of general elections, which take place over 6 weeks, and his incarceration had meant Mr. Kejriwal couldn't take part. He said India was sliding into being a dictatorship. But speaking outside the Supreme Court, his lawyer Shadan Farasat confirmed that his client would now be free to campaign.
The court indicated that they are granting interim release / bail to Mr. Arvind Kejriwal, and that order of interim release will be operable up till 2nd of June, that is during the election process, and there is no restriction on his campaigning as to what he can say, what he cannot say during while he is out in these 20-22 days.
Mr. Kejriwal isn't actually standing in this election, but as our South Asia regional editor Ambarasan Ethirajan told Janet Jalil, his presence on the campaign trail could still be important.
Well, Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal is one of the important leaders of the opposition alliance. He became very popular 10-12 years ago by launching this anti-corruption movement, and that's what, you know, brought him to the political field. And he's a very popular leader in Delhi, and also his party, the Aam Aadmi Party, is in power in the state of Punjab. And his arrest in March stunned many people because that was quite unprecedented. An opposition leader, a sitting chief minister of a state, was being taken into custody on corruption charges. And he denies all those accusations. But now the Indian Supreme Court has given him temporary bail so that he can campaign in the ongoing election, which has been, you know, going on for weeks. So this is seen as a big boost for the opposition alliance. The BJP, the governing party in India, of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And many analysts and experts, they predict a victory for the BJP because it is seen as quite strong.
And Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister himself, is very popular.
And he himself is very popular. And it's widely expected that he's going to win another term. But again, with the Indian public, you can't say anything very conclusive until it happens. Because when I was in India a couple of weeks ago, what I saw was there is no anti or pro wave of anything among the public. There's a kind of very quiet, very uneasiness. So anything can happen on the 4th of June.
And it was very striking that he used that word dictatorship, because we always describe India as the world's biggest democracy. How real are those fears of a dictatorship? Because a lot of people have talked about Mr. Modi's authoritarian tendencies.
All these opposition parties in the part of this alliance, they accuse the government of what they call as undeclared emergency, meaning basically no media rights, no rights for many of these politicians and also social activists. And they point out how many of them have been in jail for years without a trial, and how even this media, most media, what they describe as a godi media, like a laptop media, of supporting the government. What they say is there is no level playing field for the opposition. And because sometimes their advertisements are not taken by the newspapers. On the other side, when the governing BJP leaders, including Prime Minister Modi, what they call as hate speech by Mr. Modi, whenever they complain to the Election Commission, hardly any action is being taken against the governing party. So this is what the opposition is calling, there is no level playing field. On the other hand, the BJP government and the leaders point out that there is a vibrant election campaign going on, with both sides being allowed to campaign in different places without any fear. So these accusations of Election Commission being, you know, partial towards the government is all, like, we reject all those accusations.
Ambarasan Ethirajan. We've had plenty of news about unusual weather these past few years, climate change producing some unprecedented extremes. But now it seems something else is on the way, rare if not unique. For the first time in nearly 20 years, we're being warned to expect a severe solar or geomagnetic storm. This is when giant plumes of magnetized and electrically charged particles, or plasma, leave the sun and head towards Earth. Now, despite its rather ominous-sounding name, a geomagnetic storm is nothing to worry about, though it can sometimes affect satellite communications and power systems. On the plus side, it may provide a very good chance to see the celestial display known as the Northern Lights. Catherine Regan is a planetary scientist at the Mullard Space Science Laboratory, part of the University of London. She explained what was actually happening on the solar surface.
There's just a lot more activity going on at the sun. So there's lots of sunspots which are on the sun at the moment. So if you're lucky enough to have a pair of eclipse glasses, you can actually look at the sun and see these sunspots through the glasses. And these sunspots are often associated with types of events which are called solar flares. And when you get really intense solar flares, which is where you get big releases of light from the sun, these are accompanied by coronal mass ejections, or CMEs. And this is where you get very heavy release of plasma, which is very energetic ionized gas. So this big release of plasma from the sun erupts and goes through into the solar system. And at the moment, lots of these events have been released and they are in the path of Earth. So they are heading our way at the moment. But we're expecting them to arrive this evening. But the events on the surface of the sun started between the 8th and 9th, so a couple of days ago. These events aren't going to have a huge impact here on Earth. So the biggest impact they may have would be potentially a few radio blackouts. At the moment, it's not predicted it's going to impact our power systems. There shouldn't be any power cuts. And our satellites in space may be slightly affected. So their navigation may be skewed. So they might have to do a few corrections to make sure our satellites are going where they're meant to be. But it's not going to cause any panic. The GPS systems aren't going to go down. The power's not going to go out. There just may be a few radio blackouts.
Catherine Regan, a planetary scientist at the Mullard Space Science Laboratory. Still to come.
This is the pip, or the beep, we call it. Then I added this, the bass line. Gives a sense of strength and solidity and depth.
The BBC television news theme music, known by millions around the world, is 25 years old.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking, is the clock running out on the U.S. campus protest movement? Weeks of demonstrations and arrests have grabbed headlines, but the school year is winding down. Will students take their protests home or to the polls in November? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A couple of years ago, Pope Francis hit the headlines for suggesting that people who choose to have pets rather than children were acting selfishly. Well, now he's returned to the theme again, though this time without reference to cats and dogs. Speaking at a conference on the demographic crisis in Europe, the Pope bemoaned societies which, he said, value material objects over children. And he called on governments to do more to encourage couples to have babies, to reverse the falling birth rate, as Mark Lowen reports.
This was an 87-year-old Pope putting the child centre stage. Sitting beside a group of young people, Pope Francis warned that Europe was becoming an old, tired and resigned continent. In Italy, the demographic crisis is particularly acute. The birth rate has dropped to a record low and its population is one of the world's oldest. The Pope said governments needed policies to allow women not to have to choose between work and family. And he hit out at what he said was harming humanity.
In questo momento, gli investimenti.
In this moment, the most profitable investments are the weapons industry and contraceptives. The first destroys life, the second obstructs it. These are the most profitable investments. What future do we have ahead? It's ugly.
The Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has called the birth rate problem a priority, though some financial measures she's taken so far to tackle it haven't yet borne fruit, with annual births in their 15th straight decline. But much of Europe, from Portugal to Poland, is struggling with this issue, with the rate well below the 2.1 children per woman needed to replenish the population. And with ageing societies placing pressure on public services, experts warn of a demographic time bomb that's ticking fast.
Mark Lowen in Italy. Two environmental protesters in their 80s have been arrested in London after smashing a case containing one of the world's oldest legal documents. The women from the campaign group Just Stop Oil targeted the Magna Carta, which dates back to the 13th century. Nikki Cardwell reports.
Video footage posted online shows the Reverend Sue Parfitt, who's 82, and 85-year-old Judy Bruce attacking the glass case with a hammer and chisel. The pair then held up a sign reading, "The government is breaking the law," before gluing themselves to the display and calling on ministers to act on climate change.
We must just stop
The British Library said a security team had intervened and the damage to the case was minimal. The gallery for the display has been closed until further notice.
Nikki Cardwell. Now, this must be one of the most regularly ignored pieces of advice. Read the small print. But it's something we're invited to do ever more often these days, with so much online that asks you to confirm that you've read all the terms and conditions. And that applies particularly to privacy conditions on websites. But now a tax lawyer has taken aim at these with the help of a bottle of wine. Rebecca Wood reports.
An online privacy policy, often a very long, somewhat complicated document that explains how the website you're on collects, stores and uses your personal information. But how many of us have actually stopped to read it before buying that pair of trousers or booking that long-awaited flight? Very few, I reckon. But you could be missing out, as proven by tax lawyer Dan Needle, who undertook a little experiment. He wrote a clause in his privacy policy online saying that if anyone reads this, they'll get a free bottle of good wine. So, how long did it take for someone to spot it?
It's taken almost 3 months. Longer than I thought, because my audience is not normal. My audience is tax nerds and lawyers, the kind of weirdos who do actually read the small print.
Every company, from the smallest coffee shop to the biggest online retailer, has to have a privacy policy here in the UK. And many businesses across the world end up writing them too. Dan isn't happy about it.
Facebook, Google, yeah, hit them with privacy policies up to the nines. Sounds very sensible. But everyone has to have a privacy policy, even if you're doing nothing with anybody's data. Why are we wasting everybody's time?
The inspiration for his little protest came from a rather unusual source.
In the 1970s, there were people who took the mickey out of the band Van Halen for being so spoilt that they insisted that there was a bowl of M&Ms in their green room with all the brown ones removed. But actually, this was not them being spoilt. This was them being fiendishly clever. They had a very complicated set and they were fed up with the people operating the venue, not reading the instructions. That meant that when they got to the green room, they would have a look at the bowl of M&Ms, and if there was a brown one in there, they knew their technical specifications hadn't been read and they walked out.
Well, that just leaves one question unanswered. Who was the diligent reader who's now sitting back with a nice glass of vino?
Funnily enough, it was a guy who was researching privacy policies so he could write his own.
Right.
So he wasn't a real leader. You can spend my money, don't you
waste my time. That report by Rebecca Wood. If you've ever watched BBC News on television, at the start you'll see a video showing New Broadcasting House. That is the BBC headquarters here in London, where we're broadcasting from right now. But accompanying this is the dramatic BBC News theme, which is now 25 years old. To mark this event, the composer David Lowe explained how he created the theme.
Hi, exactly 25 years ago, I created the BBC News theme, and I did it with this sound. This is the pip, or the beep, we call it. It's got that sense of accuracy and reliability because it's a clock ticking one beat every second. Then I added this, the bass line. Gives a sense of strength and solidity and depth. Then I added some more drums to enhance that. Bass drum, kick, and some hi-hat. Then we wanted a big sound for the headline, so I came up with this big drum. And we can use that on every headline. And then I went some chords. The chords are tricky, they've got to be neutral. So I started minor, going to major. Gives that sense of anxiety going to calmness. And then it's a case of adding some top layers to that and coming out to a fade. And that's the BBC News theme.
The composer, David Lowe. You can watch his video on BBC Online. Just type in Composer Breaks Down BBC News Theme on 25th Anniversary. It is, I promise you, worth a look. And that theme music went viral during the COVID pandemic after TikTok creator Rachel Leary raved to the music in a video that was viewed millions of times across social media. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Abby Wiltshire. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.